Talk given Saturday, 6th January 1979.
Those of you who were present at our November meetings may recall that we considered one way of understanding the purpose of our existence in terms of realizing the eternal silence. Now, what we'll try to consider today is intimately related to that eternal silence. First, let us bear in mind that we are conscious and we perceive the body through the functioning of the senses and the activity of our speech faculty. Now, because we perceive body through the functioning of the senses, which means essentially a psychical process, Buddhist and Hindu philosophy and teaching always regarded the body as a constituent of consciousness. This is quite different from the commonly held view over the world nowadays, that life consciousness emerge out of the body. Life and consciousness and mind and so forth are more or less thought of as secondary to the material body, and perhaps one of the main influences to bring this about has been the development of anatomy, physiology, and of course the other sciences that exist in the world today. To take the material which we experience through our sense functioning, not only the material of our own body, but the material of the entire universe, as the basic substantial reality. Now, religious thought, and I think whilst this applies primarily to Hindu-Buddhist thought, it also applies to other religious thought too. Religious thought turns it the other way around, that it is the body and all material is a constituent of consciousness. If we can see this, sense it, then we shall understand statements, particularly, for instance, in Buddhism, with regard to... I mention this particularly because modern scientific research on the nature of matter is now making philosophical pronouncements with regard to matter itself in language which is coming round almost literally to particularly the Buddhist pronouncements. The Hindu pronouncements, the Upanishadic pronouncements are rather more quietly suggestive than philosophically precise, like the Buddhist statements are. So, we must bear in mind, without the senses and speech, there is no perception of the body. Perceiving and regarding body as separate self, we obtrude ourselves upon the world. our consciousness of body, and when I say body, I mean the psychophysical organism, because the psychical process is really a material process. It cannot take place without the physical material of brain, nerves, blood, etc., etc., you see. The psychophysical organism is regarded as separate from other psychophysical organisms, that is to say the entire animal world, for instance, as separate from it, and we are conscious in terms of ourself most vividly. We are not conscious of other people or animals anywhere near so vividly. If you like, you could try an experiment. Try and just be quiet and try to imagine, if you can, to be conscious, not merely imagine, because then you might be making positive pictures, but try and feel out what the person next to me feels with respect to his own body. Each one of us knows what we feel with respect to our own body, our muscle sense, our feeling, all that happens inside here when we act or talk or call, whatever it is. We are well aware of that. We are very personally body conscious. Similarly with our thoughts and our feelings. But what's going on in the other person with regard to his thoughts and feelings? Are we sensitive to that? Can we transfer our consciousness into his organism and live as he lives psychophysically? We can't do it. So we are intensely self-conscious that way and separatively self-conscious. Because we are ignorant, unknowing, not knowing the purpose of our existence or the purposes of our existence or the life trends, the universal life trends that move all mankind towards some supreme fulfillment ultimately, or because we are ignorant of that, we remain like other animal organisms, self-oriented. And therefore, we obtrude ourselves upon the world and are in conflict with it because each one of us has his own particular desires, ambitions, and drives and lives by them. Now, this is the way we introduce disharmony in the real sense, into the whole story of the life of man, of mankind, and through us upon the whole planet. Since we do this as a human species, a whole species, we cannot hear the silence of eternity, which is the song of life. The silence of eternity is the song of life, or if you prefer the word, the harmony of life. Harmony not in our restricted sense of the word, but in a terrific sense. It includes the sound of the entire universal process. And I don't mean just physical sound as we know it. Sound in a transcendent sense. For us, therefore, silence really implies the complete ending of the intrusion of our selfness into the totality. Then the sound we continue to make even physically, through speaking, through any material activity like using a saw or a hammer and so forth, that sound will not be an intrusion into the totality. And the song of life will go on through all ordinary activities. Now, the separate self consciousness, I am I, a separate self, that consciousness which is born of sense perception of body is tied up with space-time matter consciousness. This kind of consciousness is a restricted consciousness, which all of us have. Space-time matter determines the quality, the nature of our consciousness. And as you will see at once, this is confined to time and to mortality, therefore. This sort of consciousness. It is a consciousness which functions only within the sphere of finitude, of procedure, of change involving particular personal or even impersonal purposes. But wheresoever purpose comes in, wheresoever choice comes in, we separate things out. The harmony of the whole is not within our consciousness. It's only a word. It's an aspiration, if you like. And our ideas of harmony, then, are all illusory. So, the eternal silence, which is not the opposite of noise, what we call noise, or what the eternal silence is that which completely subsumes what we call noise as well as what we call harmony, music. Now it's very important to understand this, because this indicates clearly that transcendent dimension of being and consciousness, which is our possibility, our potential within us, is something which is the unknown territory. It is the unknown territory. And when we first wake up to this fact, we think quite naturally in terms of attaining that. This is a mistake altogether, because we are thinking in terms of knowing it, and our concept of knowing is a completely limited concept. We don't know that we cannot know in our terms which we ordinarily use with our knowing, that transcendent dimension of being and consciousness. We cannot know it. It can be realized through us, and in that sense only, a transcendent sense, there is a knowing, an omniscience at work. And when it does work, we are in complete harmony, in tune with that transcendent dimension. And yet we use words which indicate transcendence, words like eternity and immortality and so forth. We use words like that and believe in them simply because this light within which shines in the darkness and which we cannot see, that light within makes us do that sort of thing, coupled with our common garden desire, our longing for the perfect, which we translate, unfortunately, as happiness and fulfillment for ourselves in our terms and in our forms, forgetting that it can never be that way. So the next stage is where we grew into the vision that that unknown everlastingly remains the unknown in our sense of the word known and in our sense of the word unknown. It is not knowable. It is experienceable if we allow it free access into us. And it has free access into us only insofar as in our own consciousness we wake up to the fact that we are nothing. That is to say, we are no thing. In being no thing, and particularly in realizing that we are no thing, then that transcendent dimension, which is the creative power, the creative action in eternity, which now functions through this, which is finite mortal. And it is this power which affects the great transformations in the history of man. That is to say, as far as the growth of man towards that religious or transcendent or divine fruition is concerned. Now, we take this word eternity. If you look in the dictionary, or if you ask a person, what do you understand by eternity? He will immediately say, oh, something which goes on forever and ever. So he would then say, of course, it is the opposite of time. Because time just, or he will say, it is time which rolls on forever and ever. Eternity is not the opposite of time. All time is subsumed in eternity. Just as with a solid object, if you have a solid object, we can talk about its upper surface. Now we can talk about and really understand what we mean by its upper surface simply because our consciousness is sufficiently developed to grasp three dimensions which are essential for a solid object. And if your solid square or cube or rectangular object is seen by you, you are aware of the upper surface as the upper surface simply because in your inner consciousness you already have grasped the reality that that solid object completely subsumes every surface. So you see, we can talk about a surface quite legitimately. We know what it is. Because there is this transcendent, this activity of consciousness, which is beyond two-dimensional functioning. It is three-dimensional. Now, in the similar way, with the inner deeps of consciousness, there is this subsumption of all that we know, experience in terms of finitude and mortality. There is a subsumption of all this into that. Now, eternity then is not the opposite of time, but completely subsumes time. Then there are those who will say that in the experiencing of timelessness, in the profound depths of meditation, or in that state of attentiveness where you are free of the illusion of oneself as a separate subject, observing or interacting an other object or person, interacting with an other object or person. And we say we are in a state of union in consciousness. And we experience that which we afterwards talk of as the experience of the timeless. And we say, now, timelessness is the same as eternity. It is not. Timelessness also is subsumed within eternity for this reason. And here there you can give a logical reason which applies legitimately within our logical sphere of thought itself. How do we talk of timelessness? In those moments of timelessness, or during that period of timelessness, when the seer was in what the Buddhist calls the cessation, what the Upanishads call the Turiya state, what the supreme mystics of all the faiths call the ultimate unio mystica, during that period. Now you see, it is conceived in that manner. Therefore, timelessness in our experiencing is restricted, it is limited. We come out of that timeless state. But there is also the realization of the timelessness which is identical with eternity. As for instance, when the Buddha declared, talking to Aggivesana, but I, Aggivesana, etc., etc., he says certain things and then says that he enters the Shunyata Phala Samadhi. The communion which is the fruit, the phala of shunyata, the suchness of the absoluteness, in which I constantly abide. Others have also, there are some who have also of other faiths and in other climes who have said just that kind of thing, you see. So, eternity must be seen, at least as far as the words go, we can do it, as subsuming both time and timelessness. Now, if we see that with sufficient intensity, with our own intellects even, it will enable us to enter into these deep spheres of looking at things, really looking at them in a manner which is not too misleading. And this is important for the real fruition of human consciousness as far as its ultimate fruition in through this kind of organism, the human being, is concerned. You see? Do you get the feel of it? Now, when we see that the eternal and eternity is other than time and also other than timelessness as experienced by us, but completely subsumes these, nothing is rejected. Therefore, it is eternity, totality. And this is the meaning of immortality, the manner in which the human being is conscious, is the immortal manner, and that is the only immortality there is. Therefore, all these foolish conceptions of a mythical hereafter where you, the separate thing, continue as the identifiable entity forever and ever, enjoying unimaginable felicities which you spin out for your own self, is all stuff and nonsense. Delusions and illusions. When you are free of that, you really see it and are capable of letting go, then you realize what spiritual freedom truly means. And in that sort of realization, your whole life changes accordingly. You will find that as an actual fact. It does happen that way. So now, if, and it's a terrifically big if attentiveness and observation of things and persons, of essences, principles, what we call the laws of nature and so forth, and beyond things and persons and essences and principles, if we are attentive and completely observing, observant of them, then there can be total, if that attentiveness and observation can be total and constant, then awareness can be whole. Now I'm using the word constant not in the time sense, not involving continuity, but involving being, transcendent being, which is neither static nor dynamic in our sense of moving from a here to a there, but constant. The absolute is, the absolute isness. You see, we may say what we like, but every religious teaching has an underlying metaphysic, however much the great teachers themselves publicly more or less avoided entering into a metaphysic. But they didn't hesitate to teach that metaphysic to those who were ready for it. And they knew when they met the ready person. This was their great advantage. So, if attentiveness and observation can be total and constant, therefore, constant, you get a different meaning of constancy. The immutability of transcendence, the unchangeability within which is subsumed all change. If it is like that, then awareness can be whole. Which means that awareness and being, what we ordinarily say we are aware of, are an identity. The absolute, Brahman, the unborn, unbecome, unmade, Atma, use any word you like, God or Gottheit or any word you like. All that is the absolute totality. If we see this, our values which we apply here completely vanish. Then our senses are perpetual cords of communion, and the wholeness of all levels of being, of all octaves of consciousness, is one unbroken holiness. And this is the fulfilled man. That is to say, not you or I as a personal being who is fulfilled. You or I have really demonstrated our no-thingness. We are that no-thing. And therefore, through us, there is manifested, there are manifested these transcendent signs. You know how Al-Halaj, the great Sufi Muslim mystic, declared to the people, if you cannot see God, Allah, or the truth, at least see his signs and learn. And he said, I am that sign. For this they crucified him most cruelly. So now, when that state holds, then every action, every manifestation, every activity which takes place through that person is in true harmony with the divine creative pulse of creation which brings the universe into being, not merely as a time process in which there is inertia and a lag, therefore, but which is a pulsation of incredible rapidity with which our consciousness as it is cannot keep pace. But we can be aware of it at the level, in the manner in which this primordial creative power allows us to vibrate. That is why I use the phrase all octaves of consciousness, the wholeness of all levels of being and all octaves of consciousness. This is the great active process, the living process of the universe. It's the living process of the Supreme, of God, of the Absolute. That, you know, in early Indian religious thought, I think in that last chapter I said something about religion is the way in which God lives his life. Now, a phrase like that can help people to understand something. If something suddenly clicks and the spark flies,